Hello, welcome to Cerebral Flex's episode 40. This one's about postmodernism, philosophy. Most of it happened in France, so a lot of people call it postmodern French philosophy, but I'm going to stick to postmodernism because there were some philosophers that weren't French. Postmodern philosophy is a philosophical movement that arose in the second half of the 1900s as a critical retort to norms apparently present in modernist philosophical concepts regarding identity, culture, language, or history that were established throughout the 18th century Enlightenment. And that is just a contrast to modernist philosophy, which came before it, that was based on a utopian vision of human life and society and a belief in progress or moving forward. After doing some digging, I came to the conclusion that postmodernism was a lot like modernist philosophy because the characteristics in modernist philosophy were individualism, experimentation, absurdity, symbolism, and formalism. And I think postmodern philosophy has all of those elements, but also brings in the concept of self-reflection. So caring more about looking within and really analyzing oneself that wasn't very apparent in modernist philosophy. So good morning, Jareth.
Good morning.
Say hello to the beautiful people.
Beautiful people. The beautiful people.
My mic was muted. Good morning.
It's all good.
How you doing? You guys ready to talk about postmodernism?
I think they're jazzed.
I would hope so. I think that the exciting thing about postmodernism is once the United States gets its head out of its proverbial ass, we could very much have a intellectual movement like the postmodern French philosophers of their time. And if you look at France today and the way that it's kind of set up, they are not only a fairly intellectual people, which I think is one of the reasons Americans kind of like scoff at them as being sissies and pansies, because they are more intellectually inclined than, you know, militaristically inclined. That's not a word, but it's
going to be militaristic. What is the word?
It's not a word, but it's a word right now. they have like really strong labor movements and stuff there too. They are very much a people of an intellectual nature, which is why I think that, you know, Americans like to make fun of them because we like to feel superior. But when it comes to intellectuals, they have a whole bunch of schools of philosophy. They're very involved in their politics, very involved in the social structures, and really what postmodernism did for France was kind of give it a sense of purpose, self-reflection, and meaning right after both the world wars. 'Cause as you said, its formation was in the middle to late 19th century. Mm-hmm. Or 20th century, wrong century. And
1900s. I just made it simple, so because people say century this, century that, and I didn't actually know the difference till I was like 15.
So the mid after World War II, so like the 1940s onward, I'd say from the 1940s to like the 1980s is when the big prominent postmodernist movement kind of started. And it kind of gave the French people a little bit of meaning and debate. And in America, we like to kind of not only shit on the French, but shit on postmodernism as like this attack on Western society. When really they're trying to figure out how we proceed, because the Western experiment, as Nietzsche said in our last episode, has failed. And so what postmodernism tries to do is not only be existential, but deal with the nihilism that comes with the existentialism. So, to get into postmodern philosophy, we got to talk a little bit about what modernist philosophy was, and kind of some of the core points of modernist philosophy and how postmodernism kind of flips those on its heads and juxtaposes it. So do you want to start with individualism? What do sure. you what do you interpret individualism in a modernist sense as?
Me personally?
Yeah. You personally.
Yeah, individualism to me is realizing your own self-worth. So I mean, I'm automatically a postmodernist. But to the modernists, the individualists, individualism was all about how the individual is more important than society. So right there is already a contrast.
Right.
So modernist writers were fascinated with how the individual adapted to the changing world. In some cases, the individual triumphed over obstacles. For the most part, modernist literature featured characters who just kept their heads above water. So all about being a fighter and overcoming. So writers presented the world or society as a challenge to the integrity of their characters. Ernest Hemingway is especially remembered for vivid characters who accepted their circumstances at face value and persevered. So yeah, individualism to a modernist philosopher is all about like that typical United States movie hero that overcomes, and, you know, there's no existential dread or any depth of absurdism really that they're thinking about the meaning of life or anything like that.
So when it comes to the modernist philosophical view of individualism, do you see Nietzsche's Übermensch, which we talked about last week, do you see that as like the peak of modernist individualism, or do you think that it's more in line with the postmodernist thought of individualism?
I could see both. I could see how initially the Übermensch would be modernist.
Yeah.
Essentially, like on a simple, just like overview. But like if you evolved that thought, the Übermensch would also want to be giving to themselves in order to be more giving to their outward community.
Exactly. Because one of the big things that we talked about with the Übermensch is not only is he selfish in certain means and trying to achieve his own greatness, but he's also trying to save society and those around him through culture. So he is an individual in that he will do things for himself, but he's also trying to save his species and lift it to a higher plane of intellectual prowess. So it's kind of interesting how, again, which is why I wanted to talk about Nietzsche, because he kind of is the gap between modernist philosophy and what would become postmodernist philosophy in France. And one thing that you'll find out about pretty much every French philosopher post 1920 onward is that they love Nietzsche, and they love tweaking Nietzsche and kind of flipping him on his head and looking at him in different ways. To pretty much understand postmodernism, you have to kind of have a basic understanding of Nietzsche. Just like to understand Carl Jung, you kind of have to take a look at Nietzsche, because that was like one of his big influences. He influenced a lot of people. Okay, interesting. Yep. I just wanted to ask you that question. What you saw it the Übermensch is more of a modernist or a postmodernist type of thing. So you think a little bit of both. And I would agree with you. It's a little bit of both.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Übermensch is a road. It's a process.
Yes.
You know, so I think at the beginning of the process, you're going to come to individualism and overcoming obstacles and all that other stuff. But I think that's really a simpleton start. And, you know, once you really get into it, you're going to want to analyze your own thoughts and your own actions and who you are.
Yes.
And how you are contributing to society as a whole. And I think that's what Nietzsche was getting at.
Yes.
So I guess after all that, I would say it's more postmodernist.
Yes. Well, and another thing to think about when it comes to modernist philosophy is it's coming off the heels of the scientific revolutions, which, you know, that started in the Renaissance. You had this humanism movement. You had the Protestant Reformation, which was a big thing at the time, too, because you had people actually leaving the Catholic Church. And the movement of the scientific revolution, they wanted to understand the world on its own terms rather than any type of church teachings. And the two central tenets of the Enlightenment were you had the perfectibility of human nature and the belief in human progress through the development of human knowledge, especially the sciences, which you would think is a good thing. But then what we talked about with Nietzsche is there's kind of, once you remove any type of meaning that the church may have given you and you're solely focused on the truth and science and rationale and logic, you kind of develop this nihilistic tendency because suddenly the world no longer revolves around you. And what you can try to see in the modernist era, which was super influenced by the works of Isaac Newton above everybody else, they were excited for the potential of capitalism, industry, materialism, because modernism kind of started in the late 19th century, which was when the Industrial Revolution was just about to happen.
Yeah, I was going to talk about the absurdity part, and that really does go into that.
Yeah, so let's we can talk about experimentation first.
All right. Modernist writers broke free of old forms and techniques. Poets abandoned traditional rhyme schemes and wrote in free verse. Novelists defied all expectations. Writers mixed images from the past with modern languages and themes, creating a collage of styles. The inner workings of consciousness were a common subject for modernists. This preoccupation led to a form of narration called stream of consciousness, my favorite form of writing personally, where the point of view of the novel meanders in a pattern resembling human thought. Authors James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, along with poets T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, are all well known for their experimental modernist works. Yeah. If not for stream of consciousness, I wouldn't write too much.
Yeah, and Ezra Pound is actually kind of the one who, if I remember correctly, he is the one who kind of termed the coin or the coin phrase of like modernist.
Yeah.
The modernist age, and the writing of the time is very hopeful because like you have this big boom in the industrial age, and they like see they see all this excitement about the potential of capitalism and industry and materialism, and it's the sciences are figuring out how to start to cure certain diseases and extend life. And they were very celebratory in their liberation at the time from the social sciences of the past, because all the social sciences of the past were dictated by the church. And a lot of these writers like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, Virginia Woolf and all that, they're kind of celebrating like this new enlightenment, this new phase of freedom from the church. They had an interesting way of looking at the world that kind of feels akin to the Americas in like the 1980s with Reaganism. And what I would say we're going through now is more of the Nietzschean age, where we figured out capitalism and the things that we thought were supposed to be great about the industrial age have kind of been proven to be strawmen, and they're failing us miserably. And so like we have this nihilistic miasma that's kind of fallen over all of us, where we have like this apathy towards the entire process.
Yeah. So that's also what they were starting to think about during the modernist era before they even got into postmodernism.
Yep.
The absurdity of capitalism, because I wrote here like they were thinking the mysteriousness of life was gone, and that the you know, everything was lost in the rush of daily life. And this guy, how do you say his name? Franz Kafka.
Yeah, Franz Kafka.
Franz Kafka. He wrote The Metamorphosis, in which a traveling salesman transformed into an insect-like creature.
Yep.
And that's kind of like how I felt, you know, especially when I was younger and first started working. It's just like this monotony. It's like you just want me as a battery. You plug me in, you use me, you take me out, and then you pay me a small bit of what I've earned you.
Yep.
And I just feel like I'm turning into this insect-like creature. I'm not even myself anymore. I'm just this brainless thing that just keeps doing what you want me to do because I have to, because there's, you know, rent and everything else. But then eventually your soul dies and you move on.
That right there is classic existentialism. Right. Existentialism turning to absurdism.
Eventually, like, that's a perfect... before me, there were slaves. There are people that died before they were 10. I mean, I have it pretty good working in this produce aisle.
Yeah. Yep.
Cutting watermelons and overpricing them for these idiots that will buy them because of convenience.
Yep.
It's all good. But anyway, yeah, they were starting to get a little absurdist in the modernist era, but they really took it to an extreme in postmodernism. But the other two core things were symbolism and formalism. Do you want me to touch on those?
Yeah, I mean, symbolism is pretty
obvious,
self-explanatory.
Yeah.
It mainly deals with particular symbols that they would use to kind of put forward their thought of a bright new future, of a utopia. Because it was stream of consciousness writing to a lot of the stuff at the time, you kind of have to. I remember reading a lot of stuff during that era for college, and you kind of have to. The way they write as stream of consciousness writing, it can be a little bit confusing. And you have to, like, they kind of leave a lot up to your imagination. And a lot of the way the stories would end kind of end in, like, this, they kind of just, like, end, but there's no ending to it. They kind of, like, leave a question in the air. So then you kind of have to, like, have your own theory about, like, what is the ending? What do I think happened? A good example would be like somebody getting shot and then them being just like ending the story there. And you're like, all right, so did the person recover from their wound, or did they die, or like stuff like that. They were very open-ended with what they left open, which kind of was a symbol of how they kind of viewed the future, that it could, it was up to the individual to interpret how the future was going to be. Because they were all excited at the time. You can go
ahead. Read those books where, you know, you make a wrong turn and you die, or you can make it to the end? Like, it says flip to page whatever, flip to page 72.
No.
You never seen those?
No.
They're fantastic. I forgot what they were called. Yeah, you just, like, you're the lead character and you're following it along, and then it gives you a choice at a certain point.
Oh.
And you're like, do you want to go in this door? Do you want to talk to this stranger? Do you want to do this? And then you choose and you go that direction, and you can try every direction, and most of them end in your death or some type of horrible outcome. But like, eventually you'll figure out the pattern that leads you to success. Anyway, that kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah. I've never heard of those. That sounds interesting.
Oh, those were fun. Yeah.
All right. Formalism.
So formalism, writers of the modernist period saw literature more as a craft than a flowering of creativity. They believed that poems and novels were constructed from smaller parts instead of the organic internal process that earlier generations had described. The idea of literature as a craft fed the modernist desire for creativity and originality. Modernist poetry often includes foreign languages, dense vocabulary, and invented words. The poet E.E. Cummings abandoned all structure and spread his words all across the page. I remember reading him in high school. He's very interesting.
So those are kind of the four main tenets of the modernist philosophy coming off the heels of the Renaissance and into the industrial age. And again, it was just very hopeful. They had a lot of different ideas of what the future was going to hold. And then you have Nietzsche, who comes along and he's like, I foresee this Enlightenment movement not being good for people's state of being. Like, it's good for the artists, but most of the sheep, they're not going to like it, because now we're giving them answers and they don't like the answers, because the answers don't lead to anything that's assuring them of their place in the hierarchies. So what are we going to do? Because they're all going to become nihilistic. And so the postmodernist movement came about, and that was mainly due to the setbacks of the modernist agenda. And a lot of it did start in France. There's postmodernists across all the spectrums. Most people would say that postmodernism actually began with Martin Heidegger, who was a French philosopher and existentialist. He was also problematic because he was, unlike Nietzsche, who would have been against the Nazis, he had affiliations with the Nazi party, which is, it's kind of hard to understand anybody who is a prominent intellectual and existentialist being able to support the Nazi regime. And at the end of his life, he kind of came around to recognizing its failures. But still, that's a big no-no. But a lot of it started in France, because France was one of the countries that was heavily affected, and they were a great empire. They were part of the Napoleonic Empire. And after World War One and World War II, they kind of were in this state of complete and abject nihilism. Everything that they believed in had failed. And the other setbacks of the modernist agenda had come from colonialism, and the failure of both liberal capitalism and Stalinism to deliver what had been promised by modernity, which was mainly wealth and freedom. So as the modernists, they would celebrate the potential of a new capitalist society. The postmodernists, they were drowning in the modernist society. They saw it as destroying our human nature, that people were becoming passive to the modernist agenda. They highlighted society's entrenchment in the bureaucratic powers, the monopolies of the time. They were desensitized entirely to Marx, Freud, and the Frankfurt School. They wished to highlight the manipulation that society was undergoing due to the mechanizations of all the machinery and the advertising, the repressive nature of the ideological legal apparatuses, which were still predominantly Judeo-Christian, and the dominant discourses that were happening were perpetually being silenced by the wider voices of society. So postmodernism was really an attack on all forms of structure that repressed the individual's right to have a voice in society and to change society.
I just wish they would have realized that that toxicity they were feeling was also being toxic to the planet during the Industrial Revolution, instead of, you know, thinking that their sky's the limit.
Yeah.
I mean, in reality, it is, you know, the sky is the limit, and you just pump a bunch of shit into the sky.
Yeah.
Done. But yeah, I think they were onto something with how nasty feeling this constant expansionism is.
Yeah.
But they realized the money was all going to the top and not to them.
Yeah. So. They, again, like the modernist thing is like, we're all going to be living in a utopia. And then after the Second World War, the postmodernists are like, the state, it lacks a central hierarchy, and we're drowning in capitalism and industrialism is kind of what started the world wars and made them so disastrous and killed millions of people, because they had all this new machinery, and Germany was the industrial powerhouse at the time. They pummeled the entirety of Europe, but especially France. So yeah.
They're still number one in Europe.
Yeah. They still are. They don't have a military anymore, though. We took that
away. No, and they have to get their natural gas from Russia. But other than that, they're doing all right. So, yeah, the postmodern philosopher focused more on self-reflection, and that's really what this is all about.
Now, I think the reason postmodernism gets so much shit is it's hard to read. It's fairly existential, and it's super complex, and it's ambiguous, and it has a diverse range of talking points and opinions. Well, to understand postmodernism at its core, postmodernism attacks the modernist belief in rationality, objectivity, and universalism, and it is much more in favor of relativism. And what relativism is to a postmodernist is the view that there's no objective truth.
Everything's subjective.
Yeah. And postmodernism is also very much about identity, identity of self. They really like to criticize, and you'll hear people who are on the conservative right talk about crazy postmodernist liberals. Jordan Peterson really likes to talk about, I forget the exact phrase he uses. I think it's like neo-postmodernist Marxists. Postmodernists, while they might be more inclined to agree with Marx and communism as a system of control over capitalism, they ultimately understand that Marx and communism and Stalinism were all abject failures, because postmodernists hate grand narratives like freedom, societal progress, scientific progress. They're all criticized by postmodernists who emphasize that difference rather than forced unity should be celebrated. So it's almost, in the Nietzschean sense, they're almost taking the Ubermensch and trying to elevate it to an entirely different net level.
Yeah. They were thinking, they were thinking that people weren't owning themselves anymore.
Yes, exactly.
And that now we like focus on silly white collar degrees and
You did pay attention.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, we're only looking for material fulfillment, and we aren't evaluating ourselves in the moments that we're living, and we're experiencing everything in a very shallow way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how postmodern philosophy helps us. And I was going to talk about Plato's archetypes kind of concretizes the difference between modernism and postmodernism. But if you want to continue about your thoughts of postmodernism, feel free.
No, I think that's a pretty decent overview of postmodern thought and how it is, how we talk about it. It's essentially more based on the individual, and you will hear a lot of talk in postmodernism about attacking the structural powers that are in place that suppress the individual. And a lot of people, when it comes to postmodernism, there's a bunch of people who fall into a bunch of different camps, but some of the main postmodern people, I would say like the trifecta of postmodernist philosophers at their height would have been Jacques Derrida, who we're going to talk about today. He did a lot of talk about deconstructionism. Michel Foucault, he hated being called a postmodernist, but he is very postmodernist in how he looks at power structures, especially the history of psychiatry, how we treated people with mental illnesses and stuff like that. He was also a very big advocate for the LGBTQ community, because he himself was a gay man in the 50s, which was more acceptable in France, but less acceptable abroad. And then the third one would be Jean-François Lyotard. Those three are kind of like the main three to start from, and then you can branch out from there when looking at postmodernism. So now that that's out of the way, let's talk about Plato's archetypes.
All right. So first of all, Plato understood that to be a productive society, people needed to be reflective and truly try to understand themselves and the moment. And now, you know, he saw that people just wanted to entertain themselves even back then with just plays that were put on. He saw people just wanted plays and entertainment to distract themselves from who they really were, which I see a parallel in U.S. society entirely, is people just like look to the new Netflix series or new movie and like kind of put their own identity inside of the characters that they see in those shows. And like, they don't really come out and find who they are.
Yeah.
Maybe in the U.S. till like they're 60, 50 or 60 years old. I don't know. But he knew that art is our need to be validated and the desire for recognition, while beauty is loving yourself in the moment. So his two archetypes were the artist and the philosopher. The artist was a follower, while the philosopher was a meditator. The artist liked to be observed, while the philosopher liked to be the observer. The artist desired recognition while the philosopher desires to know themselves. The artist is easily distracted by a story, whereas the philosopher is rigorously honest to transcend the story. The artist focused on individuation and the philosopher would focus on oneness, and the artist lives through the outside and the philosopher knows the outside reflects the inside. So that right there was pretty meta and spot on, is that when you are distracting yourself in a new Netflix series, you are distracting yourself in someone else's insides. Like, someone else created that.
Yeah.
From what they saw through self-reflection. And you're just like the little bitch that took that entertainment and ran with it and didn't find anything valuable in it other than like that was good and distracting in the moment. But like, yeah. Most people aren't looking to that to see, oh, what was that artist or director or writer feeling right then? And like, who are they as a person? And how does that reflect me as a person? You know, people just stop there with the entertainment. And I think Plato already knew that.
Yeah. Which is amazing. I mean, you can see that in one of the first examples that came to mind, and one of the biggest American movie franchises of all time, Star Wars. It was a complete and utter protest against the empire of the United States that was suppressing people, like, especially at the time, which was very prevalent in Lucas's mind, the Viet Cong. And if you take it in an even more modern day context, Luke Skywalker has a lot in line with Middle Eastern radicals who rebel against the state of the empire. But nobody self-reflects on any of that. It's Luke Skywalker is the hero defeating the empire, whereas you are part of the empire. You're in the empire. You're a stormtrooper. Right. So
yeah. Or yeah. any small group of bandits that were rebelling against the huge state. Yes. I think that's what he was trying to get at. And then
not the capitalist insurrection people from this past year. Those that's a different type of rebel.
No, those were capitalists rebelling against the capitalist state.
Egged on by the capitalists.
Well, I mean, libertarians just don't want, you know, more government, but I mean, they're still capitalists and they're more dangerous capitalists because they don't care about the planet as much.
Libertarians are frauds.
They're crazy.
They're frauds. They don't want big government oversight when it comes to like basic laws, but they want huge government oversight when it comes to the economy.
And abortion.
They don't believe that. I don't care about anything that people like Rand Paul, who are self-professed libertarians, say. They don't follow the true ideology of what a libertarian should be, because anytime the free market starts to fail, they bail them out. So yeah, they're dangerous. I don't like those people.
Huh. So I guess libertarians don't have really an opinion on abortion. They believe that the government should stay out of the matter, leaving the question to each person for their conscientious consideration.
Most libertarians are conservative Christians, so that's probably why you feel that way, which is, I think, is true. The Libertarian Party, at least in this country, is fairly right-wing.
Yeah. So basically, Plato is on to like say we need to let go and realize that we'll never be in control and never will be, and we need to reflect on who we really are and accept our own mortality and embrace it. I would say Plato is a postmodernist before they existed.
He's definitely an existentialist for sure. Yeah.
So yeah, the true philosopher will constantly try to be in a meditative space. I really like that.
Yeah.
Being present in the moment and finding their place in the universe at all times.
Yes.
So I went on to write some ranty type things and saying like the outside world and social media, where we show pictures of happy times, meals we're eating, and vacation scenes aren't truly intimate or honest. And they don't show the day-to-day reality of what what they do in a day-to-day thing. Like, you're just seeing their happy times.
Yeah.
And they don't describe who those people in the picture really are in the moment. Yeah. And the philosopher feels this emptiness. I know I do. And it's all perceptions, deceptions, imagery and trickery, and shallow consumerism with vapid people looking forward to the next Netflix series. I was on a rant right here.
Yeah.
And basically, we just trust the political system to keep us safe, and we worship celebrities until we're suffocating ourselves just to get close to them, i.e. Travis Scott concert. Like, if we weren't such sheep to people we felt were of higher status in society, we wouldn't be killing ourselves to get closer to a stage.
Well,
I just hate that about people. Like, we're just so sheepish that we have to, like, kill ourselves to get next to our quote-unquote heroes, which he's not a hero. Like, he asked for people to get their ass whooped at his concerts. Like, he's not a good person. The fact that people die just to get closer to him is sad to me.
Yeah.
But whatever. That's my own thoughts.
And essentially breaking all this down, like, one of the big postmodern philosophers is Jean Baudrillard, and he wrote the most famous book he wrote is Simulacra and Simulation, which I think just about every art student has been forced to read parts of. And what Simulacra and Simulation is about, in a very narrow context, is one of the main inspirations for the Matrix films, because in the Matrix, everything is simulated when you are inside of it. And then when you're outside the Matrix, everything is real. And Baudrillard actually hated the movie because it entirely missed his point, because he believes that there is no actual reality, that everything is simulation. Everything. There is no real. The real does not exist. Everything is simulated, from mine and your relationship to each other, to our perceptions of ourselves.
So you thought aliens made the simulation? Something made the simulation in the real world?
No.
Just simulated out of thin air?
Everything is simulation.
Yes. Interesting. Very interesting.
And so what he saw, and he had a pretty big critique of the first Gulf War, and what he said is that was a war that actually was never fought, because there wasn't a lot of ground troops at the time. They used a lot of technology with GPSing and drones, and it was one of the first wars where you had people sitting in command centers pretty much playing Call of Duty with actual human lives. And he said that the mass psychosis that was going to come from technology, because it is so addictive, is it taps into that simulation part of the brain, and it's almost not people's fault that they do become sheep and that they do become addicted to the next Netflix show and turn their brains off, because that is what it is produced for. Your phone is a miniature computer that can do anything and give you any answer, and it probably controls more aspects of your life than you would like it to allow. And so he saw all of this advertising, the happy, perfect family, social media. If he had lived long enough to be around for like Facebook and social media, I would have loved to see his critiques of it, because he probably just would have sat back smoking a cigarette being like, ah, yes, you see, I was correct about all this simulation. You're simulating simulations of simulations.
I don't know what Tryptamini did, but like, I couldn't ever conclude the concept that it's all a simulation, but it came from nothing. It's just like when I was a kid and they told me just like God is the beginning and the end, and I'm like, well, who created God? Like, no one, he just is. I'm like, that's some bullshit. But yeah, postmodernism is about escaping this herd mentality and
trying to
well, yeah, you never can escape all the way, you know. Yeah. Some things will get you.
Yes, you know,
new pair of Jordans might get you, the new iPhone might get you, but you can always like try to stop in the moment and self-reflect on how you're being manipulated in that moment.
Yeah.
I know when I find a new Netflix show that I like, I'm like, ah, I'm being manipulated.
You let them do it anyway though.
Sometimes I shut it off. Like I tried to do the Squid Game last night and that shit's just too corny for me. The deaths are pretty tight, but like that's a corny ass show. That was supposed to be like number one Netflix series in like forever. I'm like, yeah, okay. It didn't beat Breaking Bad. It didn't beat Peaky Blinders. So get the fuck out of here. Shit was corny. But yeah, focusing on more about oneness with everything and everyone. And that's really what we're getting at. It's pretty hippie.
Oh, yeah. I would say that they were intellectual hippies.
Yep.
All right.
So, I only read about two of the postmodern philosophers, but one of the concepts with one of them was this whole allowing yourself to be uncomfortable thing. I never really thought about that before. We'll get into who it is later, but like conscious awareness is allowing our discomfort to guide us and teach us and examining our reactions to things, which expectation did we have? And if any patterns are present, ask ourselves these questions constantly and allow ourselves to feel what we need to feel about the outcome and then loving ourselves no matter what the outcome was. And I feel like Facebook and Instagram won't validate you. If you're looking for external validation, you're wasting your time. So you really do need to look inside, ask yourself what you expected, how you feel about the outcome, and then really embrace it and embrace yourself no matter if you failed or not, and move forward with loving yourself regardless, or trying to love yourself regardless of the external outcomes. That's the beauty to me of postmodernism, which Plato is getting into beauty and art and how they're different. But like, yeah, the beauty is finding yourself and finding your own validation from within. Did you want to talk about Leotard?
Yeah.
I need to stop drinking this espresso. I'm gonna jump out of my skin.
Jean-François Leotard.
Leotard.
He's the one who essentially coined the phrase postmodern philosophy, because he wrote a book called, it's a very short book too. It's only about less than 100 pages. You get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever. I don't think I actually have it, but I think I've read excerpts from it. But it was called The Postmodern Condition. And in Postmodern Condition, he pretty much takes all the main themes of... Hang on. Not right now. Okay. Hang on. Okay.
One moment.
Just hit the circle button and let it play out. Okay. Close the door, please.
I think Jareth is alone with the kids today.
I'm always alone with the kids.
There's no controlling them.
Yes. So go ahead and talk about that. I will be right back. Give me just one second. Right. Read your little excerpt.
I will. I'm going to read it. So Jean-François Leotard and his work Postmodern Condition solidified the main themes of contemporary thought. Leotard was an anti-foundationalist thinker. I don't know why that's hard for me. Foundationalist. Anti-foundationalist thinker. He rejected the idea that there's some fundamental reality that can be revealed by only getting rid of past myths and beliefs. He believed that reality was still subjective to the individual, much like the philosopher Michel Foucault. Postmodernists are united with what they don't like as opposed to what they do. They believe that we can't have one history that tells us what morals we should or shouldn't have. Leotard read a lot of Ludwig Wittgenstein to concretize the scientific and Anglo reality of the time. He broke down Wittgenstein's language game to come to his paradigm that small narratives are more valid than grand ones. The modernists enjoys totalizing meta discourses, while postmodernists believe in meta narratives that can help anyone. So whether you're left, right, black, white, gay, straight, whatever the side it is, you can use meta narratives rather than grand narratives to represent your party or a group, which I agree. You can't just go with one all determining like moral philosophy for everyone, because everyone has a different view of what's going on. So yeah, he was a fun one to read about. Do you have anything else to say about Leotard?
No, I would say if you want the most basic understanding of what postmodernism in a philosophical sense is, read Postmodernist Condition. And that will give you pretty much what the core is. He pretty much took everything that was being talked about and broke it into one book.
Is it postmodernist or postmodern condition? I don't know.
It's postmodern condition. My bad.
I'm not sure. Oh, it is. Okay. So yeah, I'm gonna get that book for you for Christmas.
I'll add it to all the other postmodernist books I have that I take a crack at every now and again. So let's talk about you really liked Derrida, you said.
I do. That's why I was saving it for last.
Yeah, Derrida, he was if you just look up pictures of Derrida, he was the rock star poster child for postmodernism. He was, he's the one everybody talked about. He was the cool kid. And he is the reason that a lot of more conservative right-leaning people, and even people like Chomsky, who's a fairly liberal person, like tear their hair out when it comes to debating postmodernism, because he likes to use words and flip things on their heads in ways that it is hard to argue against.
Yeah.
He was controversial.
Here's my blurb.
All right.
So Jacques Derrida was a controversial but wise figure in recent French intellectual life. He invented the philosophical process called deconstruction, which fundamentally altered our understanding of how of many academic fields, especially literary studies. Derrida was born in French colonial Algeria in 1930. He was initially slow in school and had dreams of being a soccer player. And because of some fucked up laws in France at the time, because of Nazism, he was kicked out of school for being Jewish and sat at home bored with his mom. And Algeria was mainly Muslim, it still is, and they weren't cool with him being Jewish either, so he was getting hate from all sides. And he felt sad that he was considered inferior by both Muslims and Christians, and he cited that all three religions claim to speak the truth, yet none of them can respect the others. So his thoughts began. And then he became a celebrity intellectual in the 1960s. He was glamorous and good-looking. In 1980, he was arrested on drug smuggling, which he was guilty of. But he was so loved, he was backed by the French president and politicians on both the left and right. They just let him go.
They were like, this guy, his mind's so good. He needs to be...
Yeah.
He is the intellectual version of Joe Exotic. Like, there are people who believe the Tiger King should be out of prison.
Right.
That dude's a complete moron.
Yeah.
He's like the opposite. They're like, he's so cool, we can't put him in prison.
Yeah, with Derrida, there is, let him have just one more cocaine line. His mind needs to be stimulated. That's my best French accent. Sorry, people. He wrote 40 books that were subtle, intentionally so, and can be understood if you examine them using his three philosophical concepts.
They're all big words.
Yeah. Deconstruction, aporia, and logocentrism, which really helped me actually throughout the week.
Good.
So, all right. Let's give a crack at what these are. Deconstruction is the biggest
one. Before we start, if anybody's interested in reading Derrida, you're going to type in what Derrida book to start with. One of his greatest books is Of Grammatology. Don't start there. It is essentially what a bunch of these ideas that he talks about here are all. He's fleshed them out way more. Go on his Wikipedia page and look at some of the books he published first and try and read those, because Of Grammatology, you will not understand it at all. Pick something from earlier on and then maybe take a crack at it.
Some philosopher people on Reddit are saying start with Writing and Difference.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
And then The Gift of Death, and then On Grammatology.
Yeah, so there you go. Google Reddit. Reddit people know where it's at.
Go to Quora. I love Quora. Quora is my favorite.
I like Reddit over Quora, but you know. To each their own.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We're going to be individualistic here.
Yeah. Deconstructionism.
Deconstruction is dismantling our excessive loyalty to any idea and learning to see the aspects of the truth that might be buried in its opposite, which I love. And in 1967, Derrida published his first major book of grammatology, where he posed Western philosophers since Socrates had systematically privileged speech, which was seen as authentic communication over writing, which was regarded as a mere transcript of what people might say, a secondhand report lacking the interaction and truthfulness that comes with actual conversation, which made my little light bulb go on. And he said that if writing is deemed better than speaking, then reason is superior to passion, and men are better than women. Words beat pictures, sight conquers touch. And basically, he was arguing that we're failing to see the merits and value of each individual thing by comparing them to another form in the same field. And he argued that the neglected counterparts were worth love and attention. He deconstructed key binary terms, reason versus passion, masculinity versus femininity, profit versus generosity, high culture versus low. He posed that both sides to anything are a bit right and a bit wrong, and both needed each other, and that the tension between them would always be there and couldn't be reversed, so don't fight it, pretty much. Deconstruction shows us that a lot of our beliefs are riddled with logical defects, and he wanted to give us crude simplicity and make us comfortable with a permanently oscillating nature of wisdom. He argued that we were confused about the merits of capitalism and socialism, which I would agree, the relationship between love and sex, and that we should never rush to conclusion about any of these topics, that there are useful things to be said on both sides and most beliefs. Being confused around these topics is a mark of maturity to Derrida, which, wow, right? I mean, we always think in our basic terms, like, this is my conclusion about this. This is my conclusion about that. I'm totally right about this. And everybody feels they're right. Mm-hmm. And that can't be.
Nope.
Right? So, nope. And even in within the right or within the left, you have people that disagree with certain aspects. I mean,
and this goes back to the postmodernist thought that there is no objective truth.
Exactly.
There's no objective truth. Whether it comes to logical conclusions, whether it comes to scientific experiment, whether it comes to social norms, nothing is true. You cannot inherently prove anything, because what is true to one person may be completely untrue to another. And in finding understanding, you have to combine those opposites. The best example of it, you went through a list of things like profit versus generosity, high culture versus low culture, etc. Christ versus Lucifer. If you look at either one, you can understand both sides, and you can agree with portions of both sides and disagree with portions of other sides. And that's essentially what deconstructionism is. And to, like he said, to be confused about things is actually like a mark of maturity, because what you're essentially saying is, I don't have the answers. I have what I think might be true, but what I think might be true might not actually be true. And that leads to a better understanding of other people. Because if you're not so inherently
closed off,
you're going to come to a better understanding of people. You're going to come to a better understanding of people that you might really hate and not understand at all. And maybe through understanding them and maybe talking to them, you both arrive at a conclusion. But one big thing too to understand is what he's not saying is that you should allow people to be ignorant. Because I think a lot of people like get into the more hippy dippy side of like, oh, you know, well, you should, you know, talk to the Ku Klux Klan and understand their position. And then maybe through understanding their position, they you can't enlighten people who want to remain ignorant. He's very against people who are ignorant.
He did believe that kindness is over cruelty and wit is over dullness and generosity is over meanness.
Yes.
But wanted to point out how often we unwittingly dismiss things, people in our lives, and their ideas. Mm-hmm. And I did feel targeted with that, because I have totally been guilty of that, which I'm sure almost anyone listening is as well. But he wanted us to practice patience and modesty to achieve our goals with one another, which I love.
Yeah.
Do you want me to hit on aporia?
Go right ahead.
So that's a shorter definition. Aporia meant puzzlement. A state Derrida said we should be proud to know and visit regularly. Confusion and doubt are not embarrassing dead ends in the Derridian worldview, and confusion is evidence of the adulthood of the mind. And since that was so short, I'll just jump right into logocentrism, which...
Wow.
Which hit... What? Yeah?
Before you just jump into logocentrism. I'm
jumping right in.
I know. You're excited. I can tell. Aporia, if you just read the basic meaning of it, you can tell that I think to truly understand aporia, you kind of need to dabble in, which he did, psychedelics. Because when you dabble in psychedelics, not only do you feel like you gain some answers, but you always leave the experience very confused and in doubt of all of your self beliefs. It tears down a lot of answers that you build up for yourself, and it kind of kills your ego a little bit.
And Cerebral Flex and in no way is endorsing the use of drugs or any illicit products.
No. Jareth is, though.
To cover our asses on a legal front.
Hey, it's okay. There are states that are legalizing psychedelic mushrooms and stuff like that. Yeah. Now. So I think that's awesome. So that's I think essentially Aporia might be drug-addled Derrida's view on being confused. And I think to reach that state, taking psychedelics can definitely help that. Or just accepting the fact that sometimes you're going to be confused about things. Like when I read Derrida, I'm like, I don't know anything.
The wisest man knows he knows nothing.
Yes, there you go.
And a mind is like a parachute. It only works when it's open. Mm-hmm. I can go on for days. Anyway. Okay.
So logocentrism.
Logocentrism is a hasty, naive devotion to reason. Logic and clear definition underpinned by a faith in language as the natural and best way to communicate. Derrida argued that some of the most important things we will ever feel come from music and art that can't be neatly expressed in words, whether they be written or spoken. And that logocentric people like myself, unfortunately, often forget that. He thought that IQ tests were stupid because they ignored other important qualities of the mind, like capacity to be a good friend, lover, parent, or the ability to have fun and manage your emotions. And just because someone can solve puzzles or play chess quickly doesn't make them a quality person in society. And he casts huge doubts on the modern intellectual worldview of what makes a person worthy. That one cracked me right in the gut. I'm like, okay, yeah, I suck at all the normal human things.
Well, if you think about it in a broader context, there are people like Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and these individuals that we kind of prop up as like the height of people who are intellectual because they can solve things in a technological way and understand technology in a way that the normal layman can't. But that doesn't necessarily make them good contributors to society. I would say that Facebook has not only harmed more individuals than it's done good, like it has connected the world more, but it has also caused people to become deeply depressed. It's broken up families. It's put this veneer on the world of this mass hysteria and fear mongering. When it comes to Bill Gates, he introduced computers, and that helps us with, you know, the internet in our day-to-day lives, but he's also contributed to the mass psychosis of people diving down conspiracy holes. You got Elon Musk, who, yeah, he's trying to fly to Mars and create cars that don't consume fossil fuels, but the lithium that he has to mine for the batteries to power those cars and the billions of dollars that he receives in subsidies from our government while he continues to amass his wealth are just not good things. And so just because you are a smart individual who can figure out how to play the system doesn't mean that you're contributing anything of quality to society. You could actively be harming it.
Did you write those examples down, or you just came with them off the?
I came with them off the top of my head.
I love it. Your first example of Facebook and everything goes to what Derrida was saying about writing and how to communicate. And because we're only writing and you're reading text and you're not actually having a face-to-face conversation with these people, that's why these families are being torn apart. You know, had they just sat down and talked to each other and they remembered that they love each other very much, and they might have political differences here and there, but like, they're still family. Mm-hmm. But like you said, like, it's all in text and you're reading it and you're thinking of it in a tone of whatever feeling you're having at the time, probably, that's playing a part into how you're reading it.
Or not even reading a text, but simply taking a meme that you know is going to upset somebody and sharing it.
Right.
Like, even worse. Like, yeah. We've become so monkey brain about it now.
Yeah, and I was totally guilty about that, and I'm very happy I got rid of Facebook. It's made me a much better person. I'm less likely to attack other people's views quickly than I was before.
That's not bad. That's a good thing.
No, it is.
Definitely a good thing.
No, I think we're all pieces of shit, and that we are all going to die eventually, and really, no matter what you contribute, eventually the universe will swallow up this tiny little rock in space, and none of anything we ever accomplished will matter to any other alien. in the entire universe. I just think we're putting way too much emphasis on everything we're doing all the time, and we think we're like a lot more important than we are. But I think once you let go of that self-importance, you're going to be a nicer person.
Classic existentialism right there.
Just go with it, man. Go with it.
So obviously with Derrida, he died. I mean, a lot of these guys died fairly recently because they rose to prominence in the 60s through the 80s. Derrida, he died in 2004. He was 74.
Yep, pancreatic cancer. He died at 74, 2004.
Yeah. The other one that you had written down that you wanted to talk about, which I would love to maybe come back to and we could do maybe a postmodernism part two, is Deleuze.
Is it Deleuze?
Giles Deleuze. I don't know. They're
French. I had to look it all up because they're French.
I ain't good. I read these guys. I don't know how to pronounce their freaking names. He wrote a lot of books, actually. His two big books, which were Capitalism and Schizophrenia, Anti-Oedipus, and A Thousand Plateaus. He wrote those with a psychoanalyst named Felix Guattari. Mm-hmm. And I have both those books, and they're both very insane to read. He took a lot of influence from, obviously, the main people like Nietzsche and Kant and stuff, but he was really into Spinoza as well. So his view's a little bit different. He has a lot of literary theory around movements like post-structuralism and postmodernism and stuff. There's Jean Baudrillard, who wrote Simulacra and Simulation. And then there's Sartre. Camus, not necessarily a postmodernist, but he's good to talk about in the context of postmodernism. And then Michel Foucault. But I think these two are good enough for now. And if we want to revisit it at another point, we definitely can, because there's a lot of different people. And that's not even talking about other postmodernists who weren't French. There are several American postmodernists too, one of which is still alive, Frederick Jameson. He's still writing books and doing speaking engagements and stuff. So this might be one we revisit at some point if we feel like it.
Yeah, we should, because Deleuze was all about how modern society still suppresses our differences and alienates people from what they can actually accomplish.
Yeah. I think it's... Go ahead. No,
finish. No, he's just all about how we should fully express our own power.
Yeah.
And go to the limits of our own potential.
I think that when it comes to postmodernism, it gets a bad rap because it's questioning power structures. And I think the people that mainly give it a bad rap are either people who can't understand it or people on the right who like to misinterpret it, because it is an attack on the structures of all political systems and narratives, and is especially an affront on capitalism, which conservatives really hate when you attack capitalism.
Well, we should also, in later episodes, talk about Myers-Briggs personality types, because I feel like a lot of those people are S-types or traditionalists, which make up a majority of people on Earth. Hmm. And I think that's why a lot of these philosophically enlightening is shunned, is because most of the people on Earth are traditional, naturally traditional, national traditionalists. They believe in power structures. They like authoritarianism, and they'll destroy anyone that goes against it, which, you know, we make up the smaller population. Intuitives make up less than the sensory people.
That could very well be part of it.
There's more extroverts in the world than there are introverts. There's more people that are into tradition than there are people that fight tradition. And they end up being the bullies, really. And they hold us down, unfortunately, a lot of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we should definitely do a Myers-Briggs episode.
Breakdown?
Yeah. We can do that. What all the different personality types are and what it is. And either way.
Okay. We could definitely do that too.
I think it would help people's understanding of postmodernism if they ever decide to go down that rabbit hole.
My excitement with postmodernism and why I think people should read it is I think that, especially where we are at right now in the United States. It could lend us a sense of purpose and something to strive towards, because right now we're not striving towards anything good whatsoever. And if we do have some type of disastrous World War II-esque fallout, I think that you could see a lot of people of intellectual prominence perhaps going down the route of postmodernism. I would much rather us go more towards the postmodernist leftist ideology than towards the more fascist ideology that we seem to be headed towards right now. So
I want us to go down an absurdist path like Albert Camus was getting on to. But that, yeah, that should be in our second part thing with Deleuze.
We could definitely do Camus. I love him.
Yeah.
He's funny.
I think, he was on to something. Like, if you're constantly looking for the meaning of life, you've lost life entirely, and then everything essentially is absurd. There is no real meaning to anything, and that the more you look to it, the more you lose yourself.
And then you die in a fiery car crash at a young age.
I mean, he lived fast. The guy.
Oh, yeah.
The guy had, like, I don't know how many love letters to, like, I don't know how many women, and, like, smoked cigarettes nonstop and, like, traveled all the time. And it's kind of wild.
Do I kill myself or do I have a cup of coffee?
Exactly.
I ask myself that every day.
I'm going to stick with the coffee.
For now. For now.
Today.
Today, yes. Day by day. All right. So, I think we did a decent job on this one.
I hope so.
I hope that you guys liked the subject, and that maybe we inspired you to look some people up, and we might return to this one since you seem to like it so much.
I mean, I thought I would be bored senseless, but it's made me a better individual.
That's,
and it's exciting.
Good stuff.
So, I was shocked.
Well, if this has made you a better individual, like, share, and subscribe. Become a part of the simulation. Help the algorithm. And if you dislike it, you're helping the algorithm either way. So we'll see you guys on the next one.
Love us, hate us.